Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
From what I understand, the laws against people making art in the streets or marking the streets or writing in the streets is relatively new. When we go back to Pompeii, and obviously all of the ruins being beautifully preserved, which is amazing, walls are covered with graffiti. And so I think that we're in a society that wants everyone to behave a certain way and do a certain thing and fit in. And part of that is to not express yourself on any surfaces. And we take the rules that are part of society and we assimilate them and we take them as that's the way that things are. But if we had we all grown up in a world where that was encouraged or not illegal, I don't think we would feel strangely. I think then if someone said to you, well, what if graffiti was illegal? Then you'd be like, oh, that would be weird, wouldn't it? Because that would be the norm that you grew up in.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips. David, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm pumped to be a guest.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about your story because you're one of our listeners who wrote in, and I know that you're a graffiti artist. You've built a business around being a graffiti artist. And when I saw what you had done, I was immediately intrigued because I've always been very intrigued by graffiti, particularly because I can't draw, but some of the more, you know, informative guests and people have an impact on me, like Eric Wall, you know, was also a graffiti artist. So I thought this is kind of a no-brainer. I want to have this conversation. But before we do that, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for work and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and career?
Sure. So I am actually really excited to talk to you about my parents because, and I knew you would ask this because it's like kind of a common theme that you ask a lot of people. So I was super excited to talk about my mom and dad because no one ever asks me that, and no one really ever worried about sort of who your parents were. And I think our parents are so formational for us that I think they're a big part of every single person's life. So I was adopted at about 2 years old. And so I have no real memories of my birth family, in inverted commas. But I believe that the people that love you and look after you are your family. So I've never had, when I was growing up, people would find out that I was adopted and say, oh, don't you ever want to go and find your real family? And for me, my real family were my mum, my dad, the people that were looking after me. So for careers, they both worked extremely hard and we didn't always have much money, but there was always food on the table. I had absolutely no complaints. And so my mum and dad thought that they couldn't have children. And so they adopted me because they wanted to have a kid. And then my sister came along and she was naturally born through them. She was a surprise, as happens sometimes. And she was born, she was unable to walk or talk. She had something called Rett syndrome, which is a strange disorder that only affects girls. If boys are born with it, they're still born. And having a sister essentially in a wheelchair who was never able to communicate through words was kind of quite well, obviously had a huge impact on my life. And she was she passed away. She passed away when she was 24, I think. And so she was such a beautiful light of life and energy. And she was so smiley and she loved Disney movies. And although we've never had a conversation, I loved her so dearly. And so growing up with her, my mum maybe feels guilt about it because she said to me in the past, that I was essentially an only child because all of their attention was taken up with my sister because my sister would be in and out of hospital and it was kind of quite hard for them. I never saw it that way and I never held any sort of bad feeling towards my mum and dad for how they raised me. So they were always super kind of behind anything that I did that was creative. they were super behind like anything that I did that was academic, I guess. They were just really supportive of me. I guess like the Carol Dweck thing of mindset, although they hadn't read that book, I think just instinctively, they praised me for working hard at something rather than the results. It was the work that was praised. And so I liked to please them. So I would draw pictures for them constantly, and I loved coloring books and my dad was a plumber. He's retired now, and he just had like a ridiculous work ethic. Even at sort of 10, 11, 12, I knew that he wasn't charging enough for his work because I knew that he was the best at what he did. He was a craftsman. I mean, it's plumbing, it's pipes, it's water, it's fixing the toilets, like things like that. But he was without doubt the best at what he did. And I knew that because of I would go to work with him sometimes and I would see how much care and attention that he put into things. And just when so many people start to say that you're the best at something, it's clear that that person clearly is the best at something. And I think he always had something, and we've spoken about it in recent years, he always had something sort of holding him back when it came to charging enough. But I definitely learned a lot of work ethic from him. And then I learned empathy and love from both of them, but specifically from my mum. And her and my dad both became foster carers after my sister passed away. And there's always been, there were always kind of children in our house. My mum and dad have always just had this kind of big, big heart and just have always like looked after kids. It's just been a thing for them. So for me, my path, I was always going to be a primary school teacher. That was kind of because I was always around kids because there was always some in our house and I was like looking after them a lot of the time. That was the path that I was set on. But then I found graffiti and things went a very different way.
Mm. Okay, so we'll talk about how you found graffiti in a moment, but how old were you when you realized that you were adopted?
So my mum and dad, they told me from as early as I can remember. So it was never a sit down and a big kind of bombshell moment. It was just you were grown in another lady's tummy, and then you came here and we looked after you. And they always said, oh, if you want help, like as soon as you're 18, you'll legally be able to go and find your birth mum. And if you want help doing that, then we'll set everything up and we'll help you. So they always gave me that option. For me, it never came up. It's never something that I've really thought about. I had my mum and dad. I didn't want another set of parents. And I also didn't want to turn up in someone's life after 18 years and potentially turn their world on its head by saying, hi, I'm the son that you forgot about.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason I asked how old you were is because I can't help but wonder how your understanding of what that means, what it means that you're adopted, changes with age. Because I think as a 5-year-old, you say, okay, well, I was growing in another woman's stomach, and that's the extent of which you can make sense of it emotionally. So I wonder, at least maybe that's what I perceive it to be. How did your understanding of what that meant change with age?
It's very hard to say because it everything happened. I feel like I've always felt the same, and perhaps that's inaccurate. But my mum's always said, kind of in later life, talking to her about it, she's always said that you never asked, and you were never particularly inquisitive about your birth family. We would have to bring it up with you every now and then, and you would say, oh no, yeah, well, maybe one day, and then I'd just kind of dismiss it. So I feel like it's never been something that I've because I know some people that have been adopted feel like a big hole in their life, and I never felt that. I never had a longing to go and discover this other part of my history, I guess. It was just never a driver for me.
Yeah. So in the midst of this, you have a sister, and so your parents, you know, get to give birth to a child after they're thinking that they're not going to be able to give birth, but then she has, you know, numerous health issues and she turns out this way. I wonder, what what was the impact of that on your parents and impact of that on their relationship with you?
I think the impact must have been huge, because she was a constant, she needed attention constantly. They had to do everything for her, from dress her in the morning to feed her, for the whole of her life. I mean, she went to school, and they had a lot of help, in terms of care and aid that's sort of provided. But I mean, most of the time they were doing most of the stuff themselves. And that's a huge burden. And I think not knowing if your child not knowing how long your child is going to live, I think is a huge weight to bear. But they never, I mean, it was never, I didn't grow up in a sad house. I grew up in a very happy house, and there would be problems with Joanna, but we would get through them, and that was it. We all sort of came together, and my mum just sort of carries everyone through, which she continues to do with if my dad's just got over cancer, and my mum got everyone through that, and my grandmother's 96, and she has various ailments and stuff, and my mum gets her through all of that. So she carries the family, and I do often sort of think, like, who carries you? And I mean, I know my dad supports her a lot, but it's difficult to be the one to sort of shoulder all of that. And certainly with my sister, she definitely did.
Yeah. So I think that what struck me most is that you said, you know, you grew up in a family that was happy. And I wonder, you know, why you have this, we have this sort of relativity of grief, right? Where people who have nowhere as near as difficult a life, find themselves complaining more or treating their problems like they're the end of the world, when, you know, somebody like your own mother, can deal with such a difficult situation and yet do it in the way that you're describing. Like, what do you think it is that's the differentiator between those two types of people?
It's interesting, isn't it? I was reading a study about, cancer survivors, or well, people with cancer, that and they were analyzing how they were dealing with the illness, and the people that were depressed about having the cancer had a much lower survival rate, whereas the people who were hugely optimistic and were like, I'm going to beat this and we're getting through cancer together, have a much higher survival rate. I don't know the science and everything, so don't quote me on that, but that's what I was reading. And I can believe that would be true. I think that you can live in a negative space, and then everything you see around you, you can interpret it as negative. Or on the other hand, you can view everything as a gift and view it that way. So, and I guess that's how I was raised. I've never met my mom and dad, like, I don't believe in luck, but I mean, so much bad stuff has happened to my mum and dad over the years. But they're always optimistic and cheery, and they kind of get through it. And that's just the way it's always been. So, hugely lucky to have grown up in that sort of environment, knowing that, this is a problem now, but we'll get through it. And then it won't be a problem anymore, and then you'll just move on and keep going. So I don't know what the differentiator is. I suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome for about 5 years, and I found it hugely hard to get out of bed, to even open the curtains, because I was really light sensitive. And that was at 16 years old. So I missed all of the kind of space of like going out and getting drunk with your friends, which is what all my friends were doing. And I really like missed a huge chunk, like 5 years of that really pivotal determining stage of you finding out who you are and your identity and everything. And at the end of that, I feel like, I mean, I gradually got myself out of it through routine and just like perseverance and determination. But I could view that I could view my sister's death. I could, there's a lots of things that have happened in my life that I could let bring me down, and I could dwell on them. I've looking over on the mantelpiece, there's a photo of my sister's beautiful beaming face. She just had the most magical smile. I'm looking at a picture of her right now. And I cherish that short time that I had with her. And rather than lamenting her death, when she did die, she was in a lot of pain. And she was at a pivotal stage where she was going to have to move from the school where she was at. The school that she was at actually allowed her to stay an extra year because they loved her so much. And it was just kind of unheard of. They literally just let the student stay for an extra year because they wanted to hold on to her for as long as they could. And she was, when she died, she was just about to move into sort of more adult care, where I don't think she would have been looked after in the same way. And I don't think she would have been as happy. So rather than dwell on her death, obviously I'd much rather, but like, I'd give anything to go and hold her hand now. But I'm more happy and grateful for the time that we did spend together rather than focusing on not seeing her again.
So we know a lot of you have been listening to us for years, and it means the world to us. What we do here at The Unmistakable Creative wouldn't be possible without the support of our listeners. If the podcast has been valuable to you, one of the best ways you can support us is to subscribe to Unmistakable Creative Prime, which gives you access to transcripts, all of our courses, monthly coaching calls, live chats with our guests, and an incredible community of creatives. And it costs less than you spend on a cup of coffee every month. For the school teachers and people in our education system, Prime is completely free to help you with this transition to teaching online. We've packed it with a ton of value and actionable content, and we hope you'll check it out. Just go to unmistakablecreative.com/prime to learn more. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/prime. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a bit and actually get into your work. You mentioned that you were on the path to becoming a primary school teacher and then, you know, graffiti artist. Like, those are wildly divergent paths. So what the hell happened?
Yeah, I was leading a bit of a double life at one time. So I was training to be a primary school teacher. I was working in a school with year four, they're called here in the UK. So I guess 7 and 8 year olds who were wonderful. I loved them to bits. But I was telling them to behave during the day, and then I was going out at night and running down railway lines and not really behaving myself. And I love teaching, and I just started to get quite frustrated with, I was looking at all the teachers that were around me when I was working in the school and realizing that the time that they spent with the kids actually impacting their lives was quite short in comparison to the amount of time that they were spending doing paperwork. And I know that that would not have been my strength had I become a teacher. Paperwork is not my thing in my business now. My colleagues keep me well away from anything to do with paperwork because they know it will be a disaster. So yeah, it was kind of frustrating because I knew I wanted to help these kids, but I knew that that was also going to be difficult. I'm sure we'll get into it, but I think moving into the space that I've moved into now, I'm able to do what I wanted to do there, which is help people. I'm able to do that now on a much bigger scale and with no paperwork, which is brilliant.
Mm-hmm. So how then does the whole graffiti artist career even begin? You know, you're a teacher, like what sparked this?
So I fell into graffiti when I was about 18, which is quite late for, because most people start kind of, I don't know, as young as 12, I've seen young writers kind of out there, making work, but typically during your kind of 15, 16 year old, that's the time where most people, but when I started, it was, the year 2000, and graffiti was kind of like a closed kind of club, like almost like the mafia, like, you couldn't get in unless you were invited in or you knew someone. Because now it's totally different. You've got the internet. You can connect with other artists really easily. You can buy your paint online. It's a super easy, you can start it as a hobby and that's an easy thing to do. Whereas in the early 2000s, you had to know someone. So I was on a college trip when I was like 17, just about to turn 18. and I got put in a room. There weren't enough rooms to go around, and so I got put in a room with another kid, and I complained to my tutor, and I was like, "Oh, don't put me in the room with him. He looks like an idiot." And he said, no, you'll like Paul. He does graffiti. And like, so I instantly, I was sold. I was like, Paul does graffiti. Right. So Paul's about to become my best mate then. So I met Paul. We hit it off straight away. We were into the same music. We were like mirror images of each other. But he just happened to be a graffiti artist. So we actually met in Amsterdam on a school trip, got put in the same room together. And he knew all the spots in Amsterdam. So while everyone else was doing the Anne Frank Museum and smoking lots of cannabis, me and Paul went on this just discovery mission of finding all of the places in Amsterdam that had been painted it's called Halls of Fame. So places where people go and display their artworks on the walls. And I was just like, it was just incredible for me. Like we started skiving off all of the lessons that we were supposed to go to. And we were just every day, we were just going back to these places and looking at all of the artwork. And I mean, there were no digital cameras. Well, we couldn't afford them in the year 2000 anyway. So we were just taking rolls and rolls of film, clicking away at all of these amazing pieces of graph that we were seeing all over the place. And I was hooked. He knew the spot in Amsterdam where you could buy spray paint. I mean, now in every city there'll be a shop where you can go and buy spray paint. A lot of art shops stock it as well. But then there was one market stall in Flevo Park in Amsterdam. So we went there, we bought our spray paint and just started painting on the walls, and I was hooked from then on. So I had chronic fatigue syndrome. I was in bed I would sleep in like 18 hour blocks, and I'd wake up for maybe 3 or 4 hours and then I'd go back to sleep again. And it was a difficult time. And the only thing that kind of got me through it was the desire to go painting. That was the only thing that I would actually be able to drag myself out of bed and go and paint. And then teacher training didn't come along till I was sort of 23, 24. So by that point, that was when I'd kind of come out of CFS. But during that time, the only thing that kept me going, I had a little like part-time job to pay the bills and graffiti, and that was it. And I was hooked.
So I think one of the things that's particularly interesting to me about graffiti as an art form, you actually kind of alluded to it, the fact that, you know, it's seen as this thing where, one, you're not welcome to the club. But I think the other thing, and I don't know if this is the case in the United States or in the UK, but I think typically when you think of graffiti, you think of vandalism. Like the two kind of are synonymous with each other. And what's amazing is that you see some vandalism, but it's just like breathtakingly amazing artwork. So I wonder, you know, as somebody who does this for a living, like what are your thoughts on that perception? You know, what do we do to unwind that? What misperceptions do we as people who are not graffiti artists have about all of this?
Yeah. So, I mean, from what I understand, the laws against people making art in the streets or marking the streets or writing in the streets is relatively new. When we go back to Pompeii, and obviously all of the ruins being beautifully preserved, which is amazing, the walls are covered with graffiti. And so I think that we're in a society that wants everyone to behave a certain way and do a certain thing and fit in. And part of that is to not express yourself on any surfaces. And we take the rules that are part of society and we assimilate them and we take them as that's the way that things are. But if we all grown up in a world where that was encouraged or not illegal, I don't think we would feel strangely. I think then if someone said to you, well, what if graffiti was illegal, then you'd be like, oh, that would be weird, wouldn't it? Because that would be the norm that you grew up in. So we just happened to develop these rules and laws. And I mean, I do understand it to a degree that you couldn't just have mayhem of anyone being able to walk up to any surface and deem it art and do what they want. But I do love, so I think obviously the work that we do is very I mean, a lot of my paintings are photorealistic, and they're the sort of things that people will take a lot of photos of, and they can't understand that it's been created with spray paint, and they go up and touch it because they think it's coming off the wall and things like that. And I understand people's kind of gravity towards that. But what a lot of people say to me is, oh, I love graffiti, but I just like the good stuff. I don't like the tags and all of that rubbish. Mm. And to me, when I'm kind of traveling on around London on the railways or on the buses or anything like that, and I look out the window and see a tag, that to me is someone that's on a journey. And it's a strange subculture. And I mean, it's something that I left that subculture behind, when I decided to do graffiti professionally, and make it my job. I also made the decision of, well, I can't also do it illegally, because
right.
that would really jeopardize, what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I have this kind of weird, relationship with it. I still love the illegal stuff. Because I remember that energy, and I see it out there, and I know that the lengths that the guys that did it went to do it. And I still respect that, in a strange kind of way as well. And I guess in a way I miss it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. That's why my joke about the Trump wall is, instead of building a wall, we should just spray paint a mural together.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be great.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we'd build a bridge between two cultures, the way I see it. So that's interesting, because, you know, it's funny, because I'd been looking at this idea of graffiti, and I found a place here in San Diego where they actually will allow you to come and practice graffiti. And I was like, well, that sounds like an awesome first date idea.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So I started actually in legal areas. So like the places we found in Amsterdam, these were sanctioned areas where I was allowed to paint. But then gradually in the early 2000s, these areas were being shut down. So I was kind of presented with a choice at that point of either quit or I mean, I was in love with this art form. So either quit doing this new thing that you love, or go illegal. Those are your two options. And I really, really didn't want to quit. I knew that I was becoming a better artist. I knew that time and practice, I was getting better. I didn't view myself as a vandal. I was just creating art where I wasn't allowed to be. And for me, I didn't really understand why I wasn't allowed to do it there. So it's like, I was never painting like places of worship. I was never painting other people's property. Right. I wasn't like coming up to your car and drawing all over it or anything like that.
Yeah.
I was just going to these areas that were gray, dull, boring, like by the side of the railway tracks, where people are like, I used to be on the train and see people do a double take at my work out of the window. And I loved that. I mean, I remember standing in a station in London, and I'd painted a train, and I remember that train rolling in and a guy dropping his coffee cup. And it sounds like a moment from a movie, and in my head it kind of is, and I've probably romanticized it like much more than it was. But I just remember that moment and just thinking, wow. Like, and some people hated it because they knew it wasn't supposed to be there. And so the rule follower in them rejected it. And you could see people go, oh, well, I don't like that. And then you could see other people, like kids, who just didn't understand that I'd painted all these cool characters down the side of the train, and they're going, oh, cool. Cause they don't know that it's not supposed to be there. Yeah. And you get every sort of reaction in between. And for me, that was magic. I loved that. And I think when you look societally, like, why, and I mean, it seems to be typically young men. Why is this reason that, I mean, we literally risk our lives to go and write a word or paint a painting or draw a picture in these really dangerous places. I feel like there must be something deeper societally that's going on, that's pushing us forward to do that, whether it's a displacement of feeling that you don't belong, or trying to find your voice, or almost like, I guess, like kind of reclaiming power of we live in this country, and everything's dictated to us by this government that's passing down all of these laws, and I'm 16, and I who am I, and just going out there and just sort of finding yourself, yeah. If that makes sense.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, it does. I think that what's particularly interesting to me is, you know, you do this as a professional, and I wonder, are there ways that we, as a society can say, okay, let's have more public spaces where people can go and make art, and graffiti becomes a public art installation where it's not seen as vandalism or something illegal. We say, hey, these are designated spaces where anybody can do this. So I wonder, what does that take? Is that basically, lawmakers and policy and communities working together to make that happen? And then the other thing, sort of related to that, you mentioned a 16-year-old kid. So, let's say that you have a kid who has shown, a clear artistic interest. I don't know many parents, at least, not mine, or even potentially even some listening to this, who, if they found out their son had this sudden expressive talent, would be like, go start with graffiti. And yet at the same time, from the hundreds of conversations I've had with artists and performers, I know that anybody starting at that age, has the potential for mastery at a craft. So how do you reconcile those two things?
It's very, very, very difficult. So I think that as parents and teachers, we have the interests of our students or our kids at heart. And I think that's why so many parents tell their kids to get a job, because that's the way it was for their generation and that's what they think is safe. And they are worried that if they've got a son or a daughter that's really into music, for them, they don't understand that you could literally be on YouTube in your bedroom and then that can be your career. So they worry and they say, and they dismiss creative things and they say, don't do that. And it kind of gets squashed in a lot of people. I mean, my family knew that I was painting illegally. My mum said, if you end up in a police station, do not expect me to bail you out. She was like, that's your mess and you can deal with it. It never actually happened. So I've been chased a couple of times, but I was never actually caught. Mm-hmm. And so we never had to see whether she was going to stay true to her word on that one and whether she wouldn't have bailed me out or not. So I never got to call her bluff on that. But and obviously she wanted me to be safe. And I felt like I was invincible. You always think it won't happen to you. And I know of people that have been killed on the train tracks. And I mean, I go into schools and I do a lot of talks in schools and universities. And I would be a hypocrite if I said to the kids, do not do illegal graffiti, because they'll say, well, for 10 years you did. Mm-hmm. So that would be ridiculous. But I think I would say know the risks. So for me, when I started, had I been arrested, it would have been my first offense. So most likely it would have been a slap on the wrist and possibly community service, something like that. Then as the world started to change, after 9/11, if you were caught painting a train, I think these laws came in 2003 or 4, but if you were caught painting a train in the UK, it's now classed as terrorism. So, and it can be an instant jail sentence. So I think that when I got into it, the risks were significantly less. Obviously the risk of injury and fatality were there. But so I would say, I mean, I would never encourage anyone to do illegal graffiti, but at the same time, I can't tell them not to because it's what I did. Mm-hmm. I just think be aware of what could happen. You always think it won't happen to you, but I know people who've been sentenced to like 3 and 4 years in prison for making art. I know of one judge in particular who gave a graffiti artist the same sentence that he'd given someone who was convicted of rape earlier that week, the same sentence. So I think that's disgusting. I don't think the punishment fits the crime for a graffiti artist to be serving the same sentence. But that's just the way it is. And that's something as a young artist, if you've decided to take up graffiti, that's something that you have to consider. There is the new cousin of graffiti, street art, which is a lot safer option. You can go around finding wall owners who are happy to give you spaces where you're not going to get prosecuted. I think that certainly the areas that are legal, where you're illegally allowed to paint, that's definitely changing because, and again, it comes down to money, because a lot of local authorities realize that it brings tourism into the area. So where our studio is based in East London, specifically the Shoreditch area, there's paintings everywhere. And I mean, you'd be hard pressed to go out on a day and not find a graffiti artist painting a wall down Brick Lane or near Shoreditch at some point during the day, like, because they're always there. It's where we make a lot of our work as well. Yeah. And I mean, literally you can book on a street art tour that will take you around the area and will point out the different artists and the different pieces that have gone up by international names. Street art is something that anyone can get into and they don't have to ever break the law. I know several street artists that have never painted illegally, but they paint outside and they use spray paint and that's great. And I think, I mean, our company was kind of born when the term street art wasn't really being used. And perhaps we'd rename t- to something street art related if we hadn't sort of built up such a pedigree behind the name Graffiti Life, which is the name of the company, which I haven't mentioned up until now. But yeah, so we've actually got the word graffiti in our company name. But I mean, I'm fine with that, and because I think that it speaks to where a lot of our artists came from, and some of our freelance artists that are still sort of involved quite heavily in that scene. So yeah, I think it is changing, and I think it's changed because the public perception has changed. Mm-hmm. I think that people no longer see it as an eyesore, or as vandalism or destruction. I think that people can relate to what they see, and they realize that a lot of these people that are doing this are actually amazing artists.
What is the most high stakes or high pressure situation in which you've been painting something where you had to run?
Literally I've got hundreds of stories of just the stupid stuff that I did when I was younger. The very, very first time that I painted illegally was right outside. There's a town in the UK called Brighton, and it's a seaside town. It's on the coast, and people go down there on a sunny day. They'll go down there and hang out on the beach. There's no sand on the beach. It's all pebbles. And it's such an arty town. I'd liken it a lot to San Francisco, actually. It's very, very, very similar in that kind of vibe of it's creative. People from, like, you'd know someone from Brighton, you'd just be like, oh, you're from Brighton, aren't you? Because they're just kind of, they're creative and they're open-minded and they're inclusive of everyone. And just like, I don't know, it's a really cool place. So me and my friend Paul, who taught me how to paint, we realized that we could get on the train from where we lived, which is in Croydon, and we could get the train to Brighton, and we could get through because there was no barriers back in those days in the early 2000s. There's so many barriers there now that you couldn't get through without a ticket. But we realized that we could bunk the train every day. So we started spending a lot of time in Brighton. And as the train goes into Brighton station, it's flanked on both sides by two sort of massive cliff tops. And so we found a way through jumping through people's back gardens. We could get down the side of the mountain because there was this, mountain, it's like a cliff. We could get down the side because there's this this small sort of staircase that's built into there. I think it's where track workers go down to get onto the lines to a certain spot. So there were four of us. We were with two much more experienced artists than us at the time. And so they said, oh, come to this spot. So they took us, we started jumping over people's back garden fences, and someone must have seen us jumping the fences, but we didn't realize. So we made it down to the bottom of the cliff, and this is broad daylight. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. And so we started painting trackside on the side of an old kind of train shed that actually we went into the train shed before we started painting on the outside of it. And there were all these kind of dead out of commission trains in there. It was incredible. And so we took a couple of photos in there, and then we went out and we started painting on the side of this train shed. And then all of a sudden we looked up and we saw an army of police and dogs running down these steps, kind of snaking their way down towards us. And so I mean, we didn't know what to do. So we both looked to the older artists, and they said, well, literally we can't go back up that way. So the only thing we can do is go across the rails, and there's five tracks that lead into Brighton Station. The only thing we can do is jump across those, get to the other side, jump that fence, and then run out onto the main road and then off. So we started running, leaping over the third rail, because that's where the electric current runs through. And if you land on that, you're toast, you're done for. So we were jumping over those, but this was broad daylight, so the trains were in use. And Brighton is a busy station. So there were trains pulling in, sounding their horns very loudly at us because we were these nuisance teenagers jumping over their tracks, feeling the speed of the trains as they kind of zip past you, and feeling your clothes kind of being sucked towards them, which was terrifying. And then I remember one of the guys we were with just started laughing, and that hysteria spread through all of us. So we're all completely laughing, running up, getting chased by the police, jumping over these over five lines, and then vaulting over this fence on the other side, and ran, and we got away. And it was absolutely insane. And then you have to go through, I mean, then it was film cameras. So we then took all of our films out of our cameras, and hid them in a bush and went back for them later in case we'd been picked up by the police, because then they could prove it was us because we'd have photos on our cameras. All sort of like, if we had a jacket, turning it inside out so it was a different color and changing our appearance. And then we all sort of split up and disappeared and lived to paint another day. But I think after that moment, I definitely got a lot more sensible. We then started treating things as a lot more of a sort of military operation. Uh-huh. So then the chases were much less, because we were so much more planned about it. And we spent a lot more time. So when we were painting trains, most artists will sort of turn up at like 4 a.m., just after the cleaners have cleared out of the train, and then they'll go in. We would turn up at 1, and we'd watch the cleaners work their way from one end of the train to the other. But by doing that, we were watching the trains, knowing that because sometimes the British Transport Police would go into the trains and hide. So if we were there at 1, we'd catch the British Transport Police going in and hiding in the trains. So because we got there early. So it was just little things like that, planning, that we kind of safeguarded our experiences. And there were very, very few, but then still lots of dangerous things. So the sides of the motorways in the UK, specifically leading to towards Gatwick Airport, was one of our favorites. And I always remember my mum and dad were driving to Gatwick Airport. I think they were picking someone up from the airport. And my mum said, I saw your and Paul's work on the side of the motorway towards Gatwick Airport. And she really didn't appreciate it, because although she was super supportive of me painting, yeah. She really didn't want to see kind of it right on her doorstep, essentially. Uh-huh. I did get a bit of a scolding for that one.
So I think that actually makes a perfect segue to talk. I think this is what I want to spend the last bit of our time about talking about, it is the actual process for how your work comes together. I mean, minus the master planning of these military like heists in which you get to go and do illegal painting. Now, what is the process for one of these pieces of work to come to life? Like, what do you do day to day, habits wise? And do you guys have, you know, a plan before you go out there? Do you sketch it on paper? And you know, how do you translate something, you know, especially to a canvas that is that big?
Yeah. So, I think, I mean, it's obviously fun talking about my past and all of the kind of silly things that I did. I'm so much more proud of my career for the last 9 years, because we started the company in 2010, and I think Graffiti Life it's taken on its own identity. The reason that we started the company was in 2010, I'd seen a lot of artists get sent to jail, and I knew that was a path that I really didn't want to go down. And so there were no platforms for us as artists. So we just decided to build our own. I mean, we would go around to galleries, and it quickly became clear that no one was interested, and unless you were called Banksy, you weren't getting a painting in a gallery. And so I was like, I knew all of these incredible artists, and I knew that they were painting on the weekends and then working crap jobs that they hated through the week. And so I just wanted to create something where they could make money doing art. And that was kind of how Graffiti Life came about. And so essentially, yeah, it comes back to sort of helping people. And so we started off just three of us, and it took a long time to get there. But I mean, now there's 15 members of staff that work for us now, which obviously as kind of one of the bosses is a huge kind of burden, in the sense of like, I have to make sure their wages are paid every month, and there's all of that kind of pressure and my job has become so different. I often say I spend 90% of my time talking about painting and the other 10% actually painting. But in terms of our process, since having the company, we don't have the pressure of knowing we're going to have to run at any minute. So that allows us to properly get invested in the artwork. And I think that the actual art that we're producing is just incredible, because we're able to dedicate time to it and we're able to dedicate resources to it. And just embracing new technology. So, I mean, we've just had a mural go up that we've incorporated AR technology into it. So we've painted this this amazing skyline of London, and it's a collaboration with a rapper over here in the UK called Giggs. And Giggs then walks through the skyline of London. He's a giant, and it's incredible. So utilizing those new technologies, but in terms of process, how we create the artwork, literally we'll design our stuff using Illustrator, Photoshop. What we do a lot of the times is we'll put a grid over the artwork. So I've got an A4 sheet of paper in front of me. I know that 1 inch on that sheet of paper equals 1 meter on the wall. Mm. And so from there I can map the piece exactly. So we'll draw a grid onto the wall, and then like you did in school when you'd kind of grid up a piece and then copy it over to the second grid. We do that, but we just do it on a large scale. And I think spray paint is such a beautiful medium, and it's so fast. So we can paint these incredible murals, and we can do it in a day or 2 days, because the nature of spray paint as a medium, it covers fast. Every color will cover over another color, so there's no kind of problems. It's touch dry in 30 seconds. So, I mean, I tried oil paintings when I was kind of experimenting as a younger artist, and it just frustrated me. It never dried. Whereas spray paint is just instant. You can just do so much with it. So essentially we've honed it now to just sort of a really precise, as soon as we get kind of a commission come in, we'll work out the design. We'll maybe work with the client on the design, or we'll design something ourselves. And then we'll grid it up, and then that goes to a color picker, and then the color picker will have to choose all of the cans of paint that we're going to need for that job. And then we pack it into suitcases, literally into suitcases. And then we take it out and we go and hit the walls. Yeah, that's pretty much it in terms of process. I mean, there's different things, there's certain nozzles that you can put on top of different spray cans that will make the paint react in a different way. So it'll come out as a skinnier line or a fatter line, depending on your desire. But essentially, we're using the same cans that the guys in the 1980s were using. It's spray paint's not really changed that much over the years. Other than the pressure in it being a little bit lower, so it's a little bit easier to control. But I hope that answers your question.
I was hearing you say that. I thought it was all. If I ever plan another conference, you'll be getting a call, because I'll probably just have you do an art installation.
Amazing. So yeah, I've done a couple of conferences. So I'm just getting into speaking. It's a scary. Like with everything, when I first started graffiti, I absolutely sucked. I'm getting better as a speaker, and I know that it's just going to take time and practice. So I'm sort of fully committed to that. So I've been appearing at conferences as a speaker, which has been great. But another thing that we do is graffiti team building. Uh-huh. So what I like to do is get a load of delegates that have never painted before, and again, it's the teacher in me comes out. One of the most fun things that we do is actually teaching people who've never touched a spray can, and taking them and showing them how to. Normally we do it for just 90 minutes. And in 90 minutes, we can literally take you from, I've never drawn a stick man in my life, to actually producing something that looks really cool. And everyone's posing by it by the end of it. And they're super proud of what they've done. Wow. I love that. I love seeing people and it's the scale again, being able to create something huge and then all pose in front of it in such a short space of time. I love that. So we do that at quite a few conferences as well, which is cool. It's fun.
Well, it's funny because I'm always blown away when I see the guys, you know, on the streets of places like San Francisco or big cities where they're wearing those masks and listening to techno music, and you're seeing them. And then suddenly this thing in like 20 minutes just turns into something breathtaking.
Yeah. I don't get the techno music. Those guys are weird. But yeah, it is mad how fast it comes together. And I guess, it's so funny when I'm painting with like street artists who've never painted illegally, they're so much slower because they've got the kind of luxury of time. Whereas we've learned to use, like, if you have painted illegally, you've kind of got it in you of like, when you're filling an area, you fill it in so much faster. It's just, it's muscle memory.
Amazing. Wow. Wow. Well, this has been really, really cool. I am very, very happy that you emailed me because I've really, really enjoyed talking to you. This has been eye-opening, thought-provoking. Like I said, literally, like, now I want to go. I thought about going to a graffiti school in San Diego a while back, and now I want to go try to find those guys and add this to the list of things I plan to do within the next 2 weeks. So I want to
listen to some techno music.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. So I knew you were going to ask that question. So I've been thinking about it for ages. And so the other day I was on the tube and I looked around and everyone was kind of dressed the same. Everyone was staring into their phones and I kind of tried to get a look over the screens and a lot of them were playing Candy Crush. And I think that we're all being asked to be part of the system. And it's encouraged to fit in. And if you rebel, no one will like you. And because that's what the powers that be want, because that makes everything easier and we're easier to control. I think that the unmistakable ones are the rebels. They're the ones who create change. They create a body of work that speaks for them. And they're brave. And they're taking risks and pushing up against that system, questioning everything. And I think that's creativity. I'm not saying that you have to be unmistakable, you have to go and break the law. I think you just have to question the norm and embrace your creativity because every single person is creative. And I know you obviously really, really, that's what you're all about, which is what I love. And I just think that too many people confuse artistic with creative and they're very different. Like not everyone is artistic, but like every single person can be creative. And if you can be creative, then you can be unmistakable.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting and poetic end to an amazing conversation. Where can people find out more about you, your work, everything that you're up to?
So our latest passion project is our podcast. It's called Creative Rebels, obviously. And it's a show for basically we interview people that have rebelled against the 9-to-5, people who are doing fun stuff for their job. Because the fact that we paint on walls for a living is a ridiculous career. We are well aware of that. But I just think that more people can do that if they have the courage and the confidence. So it's our goal with that show to just inspire people to take the leap. And if there's something that they love or even just something that they're interested in that they think later down the line they could love, that can be something that you could be doing for your job, which is the amazing time that we live in. So our podcast is called Creative Rebels. Search that on any major podcast platform and you'll find us. We were number one on the iTunes business chart when we debuted, which was amazing. And then we got featured on Apple's Newham Noteworthy, which was also amazing. So the show's been like really successful, which is ace. Couldn't have wished for more. And we've had some great guests on there, which is awesome. And then you can find me at David Speed UK, pretty much on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And my company is called Graffiti Life, which is at graffiti_life, LIFE. And that's on Instagram and Twitter. And that's our socials.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys and download your free copy.